In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
All right, so here we are, episode number 10. Feels significant here for the In Tech We Trust podcast. And even though it's significant, we couldn't manage to muster up the whole crew. So had an email conversation with the Recotron just earlier on. And he's telling me he's been missing for the last 6 episodes. Not that we haven't missed you and that we haven't noticed, Rick, but I had no idea you'd not been around for 6 episodes.
Come back to the show, Rick. Come on, buddy.
What the heck?
Walk away from the light.
Yeah.
Moth.
So, Gabriel Chapman, Hans Dahlin here, and Mark Farley, and myself, Nigel Poult, and this is the crew for today's show. Gents, have we got anything that we want to talk about before we get into the meat of the show? Is anybody doing anything interesting?
Brewers Guild meeting in San Francisco tonight.
Go to bed.
I'm trying to figure out dry hopping.
So are you like an honorary member at the Guild then, Mark?
No, I'm just a newbie. I like try to weasel my way into discussions with people that, you know, they're stroking their chins with their thumb and finger. I just try to get them to say, hey, I got a question. I got something I want to know.
Is it anything like the Thieves Guild that they just created in Europe?
What's that?
Yeah, what is that?
Oh, no, I'll dig up the article, but there's an actual, I read an article today. There's an actual legitimate thieves guild that spans something like 30 countries.
Wow.
Where it's, you know, two thieves went into some area and it wasn't the police that stopped them. It was the local guild that stopped them for not paying their dues.
What, like the local mafia? This is our turf.
Apparently so.
It's pretty interesting. I wonder if there's like a thieves guild for online kind of treachery and things like that, because that's all the rage these days. I read an article on the BBC News a while ago saying that they reckon in cybercrime there's only like 100 major players across the globe. And if they could shut those 100 down, I mean, they're saying then goodbye to major cybercrime.
Well, it's kind of like there were only a handful of real spam houses for a while.
Yeah,
That were, you know, it was like four groups generating the vast majority of all spam online. In fact, there was one guy who was sending out something like 3 million pieces a day.
What a
all
douche.
On his own.
Oh, what a douche. I'd like to smack him like I'd like to smack the guy running Elliott Management over the EMC debacle. But
that's a money-making douche to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, maybe we should get onto some technical content. It was Amazon reInvent this week, and I think they made a massive, massive announcement with regards to the EC2 container service. So I don't know whether I'm taking the Kool-Aid or whether Gabriel's just a curmudgeon or stuck in the past or whatever, but I really think that Docker is changing the world. And Gabriel, you and I had a bit of a chat earlier online. You don't really agree with me, do you?
It's not that I don't agree. I think that Docker has the potential to change a lot of things and change how certain organizations approach, leveraging or provision of specific types of workloads. I just think that the number of organizations that can benefit from that is very minute, like in the hundreds.
Okay. Do you think that is because of where Docker is as a technology and as an ecosystem right now, and that might change going forward? Or do you think that it's really just a bit of a niche player?
I think there are parts of it that address that, but I also think that the vast majority of applications that, you know, your rank and file IT shop provision would not benefit or could not leverage a Docker type service.
Okay, so who do you think it is suited for at the moment? Are you talking about the web-based companies and?
Obviously, yeah, it's the web giants, it's the service providers, it's the very large service integrators, anyone who is doing massive amounts of compute, people who buy, you know, bare metal servers by the hundreds every week, because they have this type of infrastructure that spans, you know, they're not provisioning Exchange, they may be provisioning Exchange for 100 companies. Right. Or they may be provisioning a specific workload for, you know, 1,000 companies, or maybe they're doing 50,000 or 60,000 virtual desktops. those types of organizations have the kind of in-house expertise, the in-house infrastructure, the code gurus who could really kind of benefit from that level of provisioning. I mean, Google does something like, 2 billion containers a day is what they leverage. But that's not, you know, that's very few companies are going to leverage it at that scale where there's that much benefit to it.
2 billion containers a day. That sounds like my lab in the house. Yeah.
No, lab scale.
Let me give you where I'm coming from.
That sounds like the amount of bacteria in my mouth.
Oh, nice. So let me give you where I'm coming from then, and Gabriel or anybody else can shout me down here. But I really feel like we're on the cusp of a major change in the industry, one of those kind of generational changes around Docker and containers, but particularly Docker, because they seem to have all of the hype and the traction at the moment. I mean, Microsoft are all over it, right? You can run Docker in Azure or Azure, however you want to call it. And there's talk about the next version of Windows supporting containers or supporting Docker. AWS are all over it. You know, we've talked about very briefly, maybe we'll get into more detail in a second, but around their announcement for ECS, they're calling it, EC2 Container Services. Google are all over it. That's the three major cloud providers right there. So there's plenty of love for it.
There's your common link between all three of those. They're all cloud service providers.
Absolutely. But I would say even within the traditional enterprise, I know companies that are deploying Docker and have it in production, not huge scale, but they are running some services and applications off of Docker. And I know more of those than I know have production implementations of OpenStack.
Well, so, that's because you know certain people. I know no one that is running Docker today, and I know quite a few people that are working into OpenStack.
OpenStack really? In production?
At least into development and testing. I know quite a few people that are working into OpenStack. I know no one that is working into Docker.
So I know plenty of people that are working OpenStack in dev and what have you, but don't have it in production yet. But I do know people who have Docker in production. In fact, was it Randy Bias was on one of the OpenStack podcasts a month or so ago now saying he sees a ton more Docker out there in production than OpenStack. Now,
Randy Bias said that?
Yes, he did, yeah. I'll put it in a link to the... Okay, so let me just back up a second there. It was somebody on one of the OpenStack podcasts, and I'm pretty sure it was Randy Bias. I will absolutely...
It would be interesting if it was him.
Yeah, I'll put a link to the podcast in the show notes, and I'll clarify whether or not it was Randy. But it was somebody that's like... It was at least somebody that's a major player in OpenStack. And, you know, they were saying OpenStack's got a great future and what have you, but it's much more complicated to deploy OpenStack, right?
You think that cloudy people are talking about cloudy things and cloudy provisioning? I think if you go out and start to actually, it would be great to get some great third party or some independent research from people outside that don't have a vested interest or they're not so intimately involved in it to kind of find out and say, you know, are you looking at something like Docker? Are you actually looking at OpenStack? Do you have it in deployment today? Do you have it in, at what level do you have it in deployment? Because I talk to, you know, large organizations, mostly telecoms, that are, or people in that particular space that they do have OpenStack. Some of it does production stuff. A lot of it doesn't. They're still kind of, you know, it's kind of at the same level that big data is for a lot of organizations as well, where I've seen $100 million thrown at a big data platform that still has yet to turn around and actually have any tangible benefit to the organization. And because I think OpenStack and Docker technologies are hot, and it's something we can all be passionate and talk about, and we're kind of like bored talking about, a VMware or a Hyper-V. I think there's an idea that it's going to take over or become the primary mover for virtualization technologies when it still isn't. I mean, I think you made a comment that, and I didn't read your blog post, and I'm sorry, but I thought you made a comment about how Docker is going to take over VMware. And I'm like,
yeah,
never.
Nope.
Really?
It's never going to happen.
Not going to happen.
Why not?
The thing is, because one, you don't have any of the ecosystem around it to the extent that you do. I just don't, I mean, I always go back to risk aversion, and I always go back to the fact that the people who are making the decisions and signing the checks are the most risk averse people on the planet, and that a lot of this stuff is very cutting edge and very forward looking, but not yet ready for a financial institution to put, you know, their trading platform on top of it.
Agreed. And maybe you've got more points as well, but let me just take that one up. Let's wind the clock back, I don't know, finger in the air, 10 years for VMware and virtualization in general, right? It didn't take over the world overnight. What are most organizations at as far as virtualization goes? 60, 70, 80% virtualized? At least 10 years after VMware hit the streets. Now, Docker is like a year, not quite 2 years old right now. I'm not saying it's taken over from VMware now, but if you just look at it, right, we used to be in a situation where we were wasting physical hardware, power, floor space, just like crazy, and VMware came along and did an awesome job in helping us there.
Well, you're just hitting the nail right on the head there. VMware came with a solution to a problem we didn't know everyone had. Docker is not coming with a solution to a problem everyone has.
Of course
that's
it is.
No, it's not. Docker today, containerization and the way programs going to written, it's not about 90% of your programs. It's not. It's about a subset of programs. It is a niche market. It's going to stay a niche market for quite a while. VMware had the potential to grow because it solved the problem everyone had.
Now, hang on a sec, but you're saying because it's not solving 90% like VMware, but I don't think even today most organizations in the enterprise still aren't 90% virtualized 10, 15 years after VMware was released. So in the same way that we were wasting physical space, power, CPU, stuff like that, spinning up a VM for every app or every component of an app, I mean, that's wasting cycles, IOPS, RAM, and therefore power and floor space. We don't need all of that. It's the next incremental step, at least in my opinion.
Containers are really nothing new, though. I mean, it's kind of funny how everything that's old is new again. I mean, we can go back 30 years and you know, containerization was,
You were new.
I was new. Yeah, I was. No, but you know, I was 12. But you know, I still think a lot of the concepts, a lot of things, we're just kind of. I think what's happening is you have a lot of people who are new to technology that haven't really been around long enough to understand that a lot of the things they think are the new hotness. Yeah, they did that. On vacuum
on the mainframe, but they did virtualization and VMs on the mainframe. Just because it's been done in the past doesn't mean that we can't leverage it right now.
I agree there.
But the approachability of it today is so much easier too, right? I mean, I think part of the challenges around OpenStack and Docker and things like that is there are a programmable aspect of it, right? And not everybody is a coder. Your standard server admin, you know, unless he really wants to dig into it and really get a good understanding of, certain aspects of technology, is not going to be able to approach Docker right out of the box and read the document and get it up and running. The same thing, especially for OpenStack.
Absolutely.
But you have a very large DevOps community or DevOps communities within, you know, certain companies that they're very, you know, it's like they want full control over it. But there's always a disconnect, right? What they may see as the main motivation to do something a specific way may run completely contrary to how the business unit or even, you know, the group that has to implement it after the fact wants it to run.
And I totally agree. But
okay, I need to take a time out here because I'm the guy on this podcast that's like, huh? Docker? VDocumware? What? You know?
You think it's a brand of clothing, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. And I want to get some. Pants. Does it come in green? Does it come in plaid? No, I think what I'd like to do is a little aside and say, and just explain what Docker is. Cause I've been sitting here trying to think of clever things to say and I can't think of any of them because I don't know what I'm talking about. But it sounds like Docker is like platform as a service.
Yeah.
Technology.
I would say so. Yeah.
As opposed to VMware as infrastructure as a service.
Totally. Absolutely would agree with that. So in the way that you take a physical machine and let's say with VMware, you slap a hypervisor on there and that hypervisor presents a bunch of different virtual machines up and we can install operating systems and then applications on that, right? So each VM gets to see, you know, virtual CPUs, virtual RAM, all that kind of stuff. We can look at Docker and containers as not having that hypervisor layer, but taking the operating system. So in this case, it's just Linux at the moment, but Microsoft are buying into it, apparently, in the future. You know anything about that, Mark, by the way?
I'm long gone.
Yeah, no, just kidding. You take the operating system, and then you just slice up the different namespaces in the operating system. So like the process tree, the amount of memory, the networking stack, and you dish that out to applications. So instead of saying, right, we've got a hypervisor and we want to run 5 apps on it, so we've got to have 5 virtual machines, so 5 operating systems, and then 5 applications on top of those 5 operating systems, you take away that kind of intermediary operating system layer. You've got one operating system, and you can run 5 isolated applications on that OS. Don't know if that helps anything at all, or if that just further complicates it.
What does it do? What does it do to data?
In what respect?
That's a good question.
Well, yeah, I mean,
data persistence sits outside of the Docker construct.
You can do, absolutely. I mean, you can keep data inside of a container, and as long as you don't delete that container, so you can stop it and what have you, and you still have your data, or there's the concept of bind mounting volumes in that can be shared among different containers, and that's not really anything to... It's kind of maybe think of it as SIFS or NFS mounting it into an operating system. It's outside of the container. That's persistent.
Okay, so we won't have anything like DSANs then?
I'm thinking probably not.
Good, yeah, I just don't want DSANs.
You know what? Maybe we should have a think about that offline and we start a new company.
Hey now.
Give Mark an example of what applications people are putting on Docker. I mean, I went to the Docker meetup in Orange County, and it was, you know, there was like 40 people there.
Yeah.
You know, now granted, Orange County is kind of slow for, you know, as technology goes, you know, we have a lot of companies here, but it's not, you know, I mean, the local VMUG gets 35 people to show up.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, I think, like I said, there's a lot of interest in it and a lot of buzz and a lot of, you know, people are kind of grasping for new things. It's, you know, but my question to some of the people in the group was, well, what application are you looking to put on Docker? And only one person actually had raised their hand that they were actually looking to put an app on their Docker platform, that they had an application in house that they could actually leverage it for.
And was it Bra? Was it the Bra app?
You know, Mark, you're a Windows guy in general, aren't you? You do most of your stuff on Windows.
No longer Windows Phone, though.
Obviously not. But I think sometimes as Windows guys or as Mac guys, we kind of struggle with some of the applications that the Linux guys play with. Things like CouchDB and MongoDB and stuff like that are kind of a little bit alien to us sometimes. I think those kind of apps, Redis, Apache, Nginx web servers, stuff like that, those are all kind of applications that people are looking to deploy on containers. And anything
isn't that what hipsters do? Don't hipsters do MongoDB?
That is what the hipsters do, Mark, not people like you.
Sorry.
So again, you hit your own point. Who is doing it? The hipsters, the Linux guys, not the majority of the market. The majority of the, give me solutions that the majority of the market needs to put on there. You may have a point. You don't have that point today.
But I think certainly in the internet space, the majority of the market is Linux-based and is those kind of applications.
Anybody doing content provisioning, right? Web 2.0. I mean, those are the groups that can benefit most from a Docker-type technology.
Yeah.
But it's not your rank-and-file IT.
I think things like MySQL, MariaDB, things like that as well. I mean, anything that can run on Linux is essentially containerizable, if that's even a word.
That's a word.
If we don't play natively in those spaces, though, and we're more like SQL Server guys, Oracle guys, which are the more traditional enterprise applications, then sure, I can see that. But Microsoft want in on this goodness here. And once Microsoft are in the game, then potentially dockerizing the likes of SQL Server, SharePoint, stuff like that, may not be too far off the horizon.
Let's get something straight. Microsoft is desperate to be hip in any space where something's moving.
Yeah, totally agree.
So Docker comes along.
They have the resources to devote to it.
Yeah, they really want to be on board something with a direction.
And I will say, I totally doubt their ability to maybe execute on it in the next version of Windows Server as well. I mean, I think, Gabriel, you said earlier on, or maybe it was you, Hans, that the idea of containers isn't new. You know, Solaris, BSD, even Linux has done containers for a while. But it's taken ages for like the underpinning technologies like kernel namespaces and C groups and capabilities and stuff in the kernel to get to a point where it's a viable product now. And here are Microsoft coming along and saying, well, we're going to have it in the next version of Windows Server. I mean, this has taken ages to boil in Linux. I mean, it must be, finger in the air, right, 10 years since they first started developing namespaces in the Linux kernel. And now we've got a usable product. And Microsoft are going to do it in, well, I don't know when the next version of Windows Server is coming out, but it's going to be sometime next year. That is pretty aggressive.
Yeah, the thing you have to remember is they did a lot of work on platform as a service. Azure was originally, and it's not Azure, it's Azure.
Okay.
Just to help you out, just remember that Azure. But they did a lot of platform as a service. Azure at first was platform as a service, and Amazon came along with infrastructure as a service and really cleaned up on them. Microsoft had to add IaaS later, but Microsoft understands PaaS very well.
Okay, so maybe if they've got hooks into the Windows kernel and stuff at the moment, and stuff that they can leverage and build on, maybe that's doable for them then. But once they are doing it, then we've got a great ecosystem around containers. Personal opinion, it could all crash and burn overnight, and I could be wrong, but I don't know, I just really have this kind of feeling that this is something, it really does remind me of when I first came across VMware, and I wasn't particularly early to VMware, I really started looking at it when it was version 2.5, but I remember the first time I saw it, I was like, man, I just get this. And maybe I do play in the Linux space a little bit more than some of you guys, I don't know, but it's something that when I play around with it, it just got this gut feeling like, there's something going on here that's pretty big for the industry.
So my question is, who's going to buy them?
Yeah, VMware.
VDocumware.
Yeah.
VDocumware. after they spin out of EMC.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, because when I went to my first OpenStack summit, which was Atlanta, right? So I was a little late to the game to actually go to a conference because I was really, I'm curious. I'm more curious about this than I am practically when you implement it. It's just not the space that I work in anymore. Implementation of these types of technologies for the most part. But I'm curious, there was so much buzz around it there. I mean, it really was big. They did the brown bag session. The room was full.
Sorry, Gabriel, are you talking about OpenStack or Docker here?
Docker at
right.
OpenStack
yeah.
Summit, right?
In Atlanta, yeah.
Yeah, and, but my question was like, well, this seems pretty revolutionary. It seems pretty disruptive. Let's throw out the buzzwords. But who has the most to gain from purchasing them this early on before they get too big too fast?
Because Cisco,
their trajectory is pretty steep, but they have not taken a whole bunch of money yet. I mean, I'd have to go look at Crunchbase. I would hazard a guess it's under $40 million.
No, it's about $40 million. That's about right.
Right.
I don't know about you guys, but I know in the big world, it doesn't seem like a lot of money, but it seems like a lot of money to me. 40 million.
You'd have some of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all software.
I'll take 40 million. it is all software. And it was only like, 40, it wasn't even 40 people. And the one point that they made when at the meetup was, they don't make money on, they don't really sell anything other than a few aspects of more access and some support. One of the things is like, he said is like, hey, we make money off selling t-shirts and stickers too.
you know who they want to buy them? Facebook. Nobody overpays like Facebook.
Oh, don't they just? I know. Good grief.
Well, I'm serious. Why all those Windows phone apps.
I'm serious.
To your point, Gabriel, there is value in not selling and focusing on technology early on. I mean, I don't care about if you don't sell anything in the first 2-3 years of being into deployment.
What did VMware sell to EMC for? $600 million or something like that?
That's about right, yeah.
Not even a billion. Yeah, 640. Docker wants to go 10x that.
Yeah, and Facebook would pay that.
Facebook would pay 10 times that probably because, they'll pay 20 million or 20 billion rather for messaging.
Yeah, that was, dear me, yeah.
But what stops, I don't think anything would stop Facebook or Google themselves from developing the same, an almost clone of the technology that's more suited to their environments.
But that's really interesting, Gabriel, because Google are pretty famous at saying they run everything internally in a container. And did you say earlier on 2 billion containers a day they consume?
That's the number I saw. It's some gigantic number.
Yeah, yet they are all over Docker, and their recently open source Kubernetes kind of management orchestration suite, that's not the right word, but for Docker, why are they so all over Docker if they potentially have something else that's container-based internally? Why don't they just bring that to market and blow Docker away?
Because there's not enough white space in it.
Not enough what?
White space. I'm bagging on Google applications because they're all full of white space.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Wait a minute, though. Nigel, if you brought orchestration to Docker, would that be dorkestration?
That's a good point. But you know what? I think orchestration and management and things like that are the major part of the ecosystem that's missing. So I think Docker as a core technology, personally, is ready in certain instances for the prime time, but it does not have the kind of ecosystem that enterprises and people want. But again, I'd go back to the early days of VMware. They had a core hypervisor. Now they've got this awesome portfolio, but they didn't acquire it and they didn't build it overnight.
No, and I think technologies that are sea change events don't. You know, it does take a decade to get to that level. I mean, you know, companies that have stickiness and staying power and a product portfolio that can really, you know, be something that sits in every data center, yeah, they eventually morph into much larger things. If VMware doesn't get bought by EMC, or majority portion of it by EMC, do they get to the level that they're at today without that parent organization to help drive?
Or would vSAN already be working?
Maybe we'll talk about that a bit later. So maybe that's enough about Docker now. I'm on the Kool-Aid. Mark still thinks that they make shoes and trousers and stuff. And Gabriel and Hans, you totally disagree with me, yeah?
Yes.
Is that a fair assessment?
Totally.
I don't totally disagree, but I think that it's still too early to make a claim that, you know, they're going to displace any entrenched giants.
You just need to be more of a visionary like me, that's all.
Yeah, we're lining up. I'm lining up with Nigel.
There's more to disruption than just being a good technology, that's all.
And having a cool, awesome company logo, yeah?
It is a good logo.
It is a good logo, yeah. So what do we want to talk about next, gents?
Oh, I think, what was it that Tucci said this week? Talking about the fact that they had internal conflict.
Conflict. That's not what you described it as earlier on, Mark.
What did I say earlier?
You know, I care to tell us
the whole thing about not remembering anything.
Was it cannibalism?
Oh, there was a little bit. Yeah, they're competing with each other, and it's a very interesting discussion around that, especially in terms of, you know, the hostile pressure from stockholders. What's guy's name again? I can never remember his name.
Singer? Paul Singer.
Paul Singer, yeah. You know, the pressure to break up the company, and then to have Tucci talk about the fact that you've got products competing internally, which, you know, just fuels Singer's argument. You know, these guys are wasting resources. They're not leveraging each other. They're competing with each other. Very, very interesting discussion.
Do you think that was foot in the mouth there by Tucci then?
I do.
Apparently the quote is, there is always friction. I think some friction is good. And to be honest, there is more friction than we should have today.
Okay. So because they're under a bit of pressure from their earnings per share, right? Maybe that was his attempt at saying, we know what the issue is. I mean, that there are bigger issues than that behind it. Of course, they've made a lot of investments and they take time to mature. But maybe he's saying, you know, we go ahead and we fix that and we have a more unified approach when we go into customers, because one of the things that Joe was definitely talking about was you've got to be big to compete with the big guys, with the Amazons, the Microsofts, the Googles, the Ciscos, the HPs, the IBMs. If you're not big, you can't compete against those guys. And I'm sure he said, if you're not big, you need to be niche. And they're not Docker either, are they? So,
it's going to be very interesting to watch this.
I picked up a lot of talk. I mean, some of the reading between the lines I saw was, or at least some of the commentary that was noted, was the spinoff or divestiture of some of the properties. So is this just foreshadowing of VMware moving away? I'm not sure yet. I mean, it's still brought up, it's still discussed. It's like the 800 pound and the gorilla when it comes, or, you know, the 800 pound gorilla in the room when people talk about the federation of companies.
Yeah. Hans, did you say you agreed or you disagreed?
No, I totally agree with Tucci there, for multiple reasons. Being big is In size is pretty important to remain big and be the biggest. But another aspect is I don't see, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't see VMware doing that well alone being spun off by EMC.
Especially since they're going to be ravaged by Docker, right?
Oh, come on.
No, I'm just...
Can you leave that alone?
Yeah, I will now.
No, but there's a big chance VMware is not going to have the growth as it had in the last years, right? I think we could say that we're kind of going to a top...
peak virtualization.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure they're going to be big in the ecosystem if not being led by EMC.
Okay.
There could be a lot of ships moving if VMware gets spun off out of EMC, I think a lot of ships could be moving away from VMware.
That would be very interesting. I definitely think that they're better off in EMC. And the whole Elliott thing, I've said this on the podcast before, but it grinds on me something rotten because EMC, in my opinion, of all of those big companies that we mentioned, and I'm not talking about the public cloud guys, right, but the traditional IT infrastructure companies, EMC are the ones that are turning it on all the time. Those guys are delivering, they're acquiring, they're integrating, they're innovating, you know, as far as big companies do that stuff, right? And I'd be gutted if they got broke up. Gut feel for me is that they won't. Where do the rest of you guys stand on where you think this will end up going?
Well, I always thought the Federation strategy was a great one. Different fences or different castles of technology that can protect the company from, you know, all different kinds of things that go on inside the industry. And as a big company, you know, you need that, right? So I thought that they were building a terrific fortress there. And yeah, there's going to be some amount of overlap, but I've always thought it was a brilliant strategy. So I'm like you, Nigel, I'm gutted. It's like, so, you know, activist stockholder wants to come in and tear down the protection that the company's been building for itself. And that doesn't seem right to me, but I do understand the economics too, right? And the thing that Tucci said this week, yeah, we compete internally. Yeah, you know, that is really wasting resources to do that. Other companies do it though too, right? I think if you looked at all the other companies that Tucci named as competitors, IBM, Cisco, Microsoft, HP, Amazon, you know, Google, you name all these guys, they've got instances where they'll have two or three different types of initiatives, you know, being developed at the same time that would compete in the market against each other. So I don't think it's anything that bad that EMC is doing with that. It's just, it came out that way.
I do think that Tucci needs to do something now to at least make some kind of decisions this whole Elliott thing is not doing anyone any service today. Something needs to happen.
When will it happen though? Because isn't Joe, he's scheduled to retire first quarter next year, isn't he?
He's not going to wait for that. He wants to leave with a legacy.
It jeopardizes his legacy. Right. He has to leave this Elliott system or this Elliott issue resolved before he leaves.
Yes.
He's not going to leave in the middle of it. And, you know, what the Elliott does is it kind of forces them to open up more about the overarching Federation strategy, at least to placate the shareholders that are unhappy, you know, which apparently is just Elliott at this point. But, you know, there's a financial motive behind what Elliott does. It's nothing about what's good for EMC or the Federation.
Or for the market.
For Elliott's return on investment.
Yes.
Totally, totally agree. And that's what hurts me.
Well, does anybody know how much traction Elliott's got with the EMC shareholders right now? I mean, if they were to vote today, you know, would he have 24%? Would he have 12%? You know, how many would be with him?
The thing is, I don't know the answer to that question, Mark, but I imagine if they can put a good case together that says, by breaking the company up, we would make XYZ $1 million, and so would you. You'd make so much percentage on each share that you have. That's a big number. Shareholders are shareholders at the end of the day. They're not technologists like us. They don't look at EMC and think, man, this is an awesome institution of a company, and we get the technology and we get what they're trying to do. They don't care about stuff like that, right? Or am I wrong?
No,
yeah, but it's only if they liquidate their shares that they get that benefit. You know, a lot of these organizations, institutional investors, they buy and hold.
Yeah, but if there's a windfall on something like that, I'd liquidate. But
how big is the windfall going to be? Is it a 30% bump in the stock? Is it 5% or 3%? Is it really worth it at that point?
And that's going to be what tips it really, isn't it?
One of the reasons Tucci needs to handle this as fast as possible is how much time do you want to give them to make a case?
Yeah.
He should have closed that conversation already weeks ago.
How do you do that? I don't understand how does he close that off? Do they have to?
Yeah, if you don't sell VMware, you don't close anything. It's still an open issue as far as Sigma's concerned.
Yeah, and then when can Tucci retire? Does he holds them off for the time being? And if they don't sell their shares and they stick around, as soon as he's gone out the door, that's window of opportunity for them again, right?
Well, I think he said that they're going to announce their numbers in January. And he believes that their year-end numbers or the quarter, I don't know if it's a year-end or quarter-end, that will give them some basis for understanding this. And that makes sense. I mean, it makes sense to have the discussion when you roll up the numbers. My guess is that EMC and Tucci are doing a bunch of things. I wouldn't say cooking the books, that's wrong, but I think they're going to make them look pretty good as best they can. I mean, you know, there's always a certain amount of slop involved in how the bookkeeping's done. I mean, it's a tough thing. It's a big company. There's all kinds of stuff. They're going to pull in everything, right? And it's going to look super great, right? And the question of the shareholders are going to be, you want to stop this? I think that's what he's. I think that's what he's hoping for.
Because they're poised in some pretty decent markets, I think, of the traditional infrastructure players to benefit in those markets. They've acquired some pretty damn interesting technologies, not just even on like the Scale.io and Extreme.io front, but is it DSSD and then the whole Pivotal thing, which I think a lot of us think, you know, these guys are going to be interesting players going forward. But it's how long does it take before those guys start raking in the money is the difficulty, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, who knows? I mean, that Pivotal's a long-range bet.
So I think actually on the topic of EMC, one of you guys were pointing out an article that Robin Harris, Storage Mojo, had posted recently this week. Anybody want to take the reins on that one?
Yeah, I'll take it. Robin Harris wrote this piece, and let's see, what's it called? I have it up on my machine. It's called EMC's Re-Intermediation Strategy. And just so people know, Robin and EMC don't necessarily get along. In fact, on his blog, link roll, on the top of his greatest hits, the link says EMC threatens Storage Mojo. Storage Mojo is his pseudonym. Yeah. Right. So, and so there's no love lost between the two, but it's a really interesting post. And in it, Robin, points to the, acquisitions that have been made recently by EMC, TwinStrata, Cloud Scaling, Maginatics, Spanning. And he's saying that EMC is trying to get itself reinserted as a company that provides technology that helps you do things with the cloud. And he questions whether or not a IT technology company like EMC can actually make a product that successfully does anything for customers with the cloud when EMC doesn't have its own cloud. They're not really selling cloud services. His argument is basically people go to the cloud directly to get what they need. They don't need this other stuff in there. And it's a darn interesting article to read. And it's a good question, right? How can companies, and you can apply it to much more than EMC, how can companies like HP, like IBM, you name it, if they're not providing cloud services, can they really offer any products that they can make money off based on getting you to the cloud or doing things in the cloud?
So are they, in principle, making it easier for existing enterprise customers to consume public cloud-based services? Well, I'm trying to get my head around this then. Would they be an on-ramp and potentially an off-ramp to public cloud services?
So the analogy he makes, and I think it's a good analogy in the discussion. I'm not sure the analogy plays the same thing. The analogy he makes is a local small bookstore looking up Amazon books for you as a customer.
That's a hilarious analogy, but it's a good one, I think.
It is actually. That's really good because you know what? You and I would never go and do that, but the older generation quite possibly would. You know, those that don't really want to go and do Amazon themselves, they're not internet savvy and what have you. maybe that works for those traditional enterprise organizations that aren't in a position to go and consume public cloud resources themselves. Have somebody as kind of a broker for you, somebody that you trust. That's a pretty good analogy.
I would go to an empty bookstore to someone that helps me pick the right book.
Really?
Why not?
Because if you just go straight to Amazon yourself with all the book reviews, the 5 stars, the write-ups, you've got collective wisdom there versus what one guy at a local bookstore tells you. You wouldn't, Hans?
There's
a
lot of value in the trusted advisor role. That's the one we play.
That's a good point, actually. Yes, there is a lot
of that. And understanding what the customer is actually looking for and having worked with them for a long time. I mean, some of these vendors have long-standing relationships where they have helped focus and strategize with the company or with the customer to provide a solution that's really going to benefit them almost as a consigliere, right, you know, to the Don. You know, he trusts them. He trusts what they have to say, and he's not stirred them wrong. And, yeah, they've paid for their services, but there's been a great benefit and kept the lights on.
Did you say to the Don?
The Don, the consigliere.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, I like that. But serious question here then. Do you think a lot of organizations out there see the likes of EMC, HP, IBM, Cisco, people like that, as trusted advisors? And I'm being genuine here. Or do you think that they think, you know what, these guys have been overcharging us and fleecing us and taking advantage of us for the last 10 years, whatever? Because I think there's a bunch of that out there as well. I think trusted advisor for consultants and things, maybe. But a lot of these big companies, we buy from them because, well, number one, you don't get fired for buying technologies from a lot of these guys. And they've got a big badge and, you know, supposedly big support organizations behind them. But a lot of us begrudge doing it and have done for a while.
Let me tell you something. Customers have no clue where the money of a product they buy goes to. They have no idea how much margin goes to who, to the distributor, to the reseller, to the vendor. They have no idea how much a disc costs and how much they paid for it.
True for some customers, I would agree, yeah.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is that's one of the reasons why EMC doesn't like Robin. Robin used to publish street price lists, and that's what really caused the rancor within EMC. In fact, I think I've heard that there are, you know, internal memos and whatnot at EMC that nobody is supposed to talk to Robin about anything ever, right?
Technically that's a trade secret, right?
I mean, but if you collect money from the street,
the customer gets it. Yeah, I mean, certain customers are going to get, you know, it's like, hey, it's kind of like, you know, is Robin the you know, the Kelly Blue Book or, you know, of the storage industry. So it's everybody can kind of go and know what they're paying for the components and understand what the markup is and then go out and do the negotiation on their own.
So to answer your question, Nigel, I think it will take time, but, and it depends on whether or not technologies like OpenStack actually burst through. But let's say OpenStack succeeds as being a private cloud technology that is adopted widely and used for any number of purposes, including storage, including Swift, right? What happens to the big box vendors then when people can buy commodity hardware? It's like what VMware did. Basically, you can use any server you like with our product. It doesn't matter. You can move your virtual server from HP to Dell to Avnet to your own white box, and it all runs the same.
But does it run the same? We've had at least a couple of issues. I'm not going to knock vSAN here again, but there have been hardware-related issues with vSAN, with hardware components that are on the HCL and that have potentially got that designed for vSAN logo against it.
That's why it's a 1.0 product.
Yeah, HCL.
I'm not kidding. I mean, we've had this discussion. This is okay. This is not. If you are running vSAN today in a big production environment, dumb on you. Your mistake.
So I say something like that on Twitter, and I am lambasted like nothing else. It's unbelievable. I can't say that on Twitter because people are all over me. Oh, vSAN's production ready. People are using it for tier one, for high performance, all of this. I'm shot down like nothing else if I say something like that.
I think vSAN is a great product.
Keep in mind who's shooting you down too, though.
Oh, I totally do keep in mind who's shooting me down. And they work for VMware or... Duncan was heavy on me last time.
Well, yeah, Duncan would be, yeah.
It's his baby.
Of course, yeah. But a serious question here as well. Not that that wasn't serious, but what is the value of an HCL? If you can take components that are on there and build your infrastructure from those, and then they tank in performance when you have a failed disk.
Well, there's only two things you can do here, and you can agree or disagree on them. You either put a lot of products in there, making it possible for a lot of people to start using your product, or you put only one or two products in there, and then people are like, oh, I really have to buy that one.
Why, the whole concept of the vSAN ready node is, hey, here's the truly qualified hardware. Oh, yeah, you can do it on anything you buy off the shelf that's in the HCL. But if you really want it to work in production and be supported, buy this box.
That's actually a good one. Is there any of the vSAN ready nodes or one of the baked-in configurations that has failed in that matter?
That's a good question.
That's a good question. But the other question is, does that mean that the HCL is now a marketing program, purely a marketing program?
No. There's a lot of products in the ACL, and there's a lot of quality assessment to do to bring a product in there. I'm not sure.
Apparently not.
That you can cover every single bug that can happen with every single product that is in there with every single firmware release.
And no, the regression testing and all
I'm
the
okay
work that
it
that.
Should be. It should be, but you cannot cover yourself for everything.
I agree, right? But let's think what we're looking at here, right? One of the major issues that they've had is at least one of the RAID cards that were on the HCL just cannot rebuild a disk and serve production I/O at the same time. Now, I'm sorry, that's not regression testing. That's not anything difficult. That is storage area networking 101. Disks fail all the time, and big disks these days take ages to rebuild. And if you can't rebuild and serve production I/O at the same time, how does that get on the HCL? Mark, I think it's marketing. I think you might be onto something there. Opening it up to us, you know, to say we are truly software defined because look at the length of this big old list of the HCL. Where's the testing behind that? What value do I put into an HCL now?
But it also makes the case for the integrated system, right? It's like,
yes,
hey,
it does.
You can do it yourself. You can do it yourself. It won't be at the same level of what you can buy from an EMC or an HP or somebody of that nature, a true storage vendor who that's what they do. That's their bread and butter. It's how they keep, you know, that's how they pay their bills. These systems are qualified. They're heavily tested. And they're designed in such a fashion versus the roll your own approach, which has value for a certain type of customer, not every customer. And I think that's the caveat you have to look at something when it's a software-defined solution that you're basically going out against a broad, diverse HCL, is that you're going to not get the best performance and the best effort compared to something that's designed, and that's why you pay a premium.
Yeah. It's not because a component is on the HCL that component will work in every single configuration you are going to make with that component. There's a lot of other components that come in there as well. I mean, the amount of disks, the type of disks you put in there, there's nothing that says if you take this component out of the HCL, being a RAID controller, that is the disk you can choose to go next to it. No, you're going to choose just another disk out of the HCL. You're not sure yourself if that is the perfect combination. It could work. Both products apart have been tested and qualified. They have not been tested and qualified together.
Yeah, I agree. And that is a fair point there. I should also point out that because I've been vocal in the past in favor of the VSA architecture versus vSAN, if a VSA was to use any of these components in it as well, that are not high grade components, they'd no doubt be open to the very same problems there as well.
Exactly.
So this isn't a vSAN architectural specific problem. I think we're just talking about HCLs and that idea that just because, like you say there, something is on the HCL and another component is, you can't necessarily throw the two together and have an awesome solution.
Okay, so let's talk about cloud object storage then, like you have at Google, Amazon, Microsoft, you know, the big data centers, Facebook, you know, that kind of thing, right? These companies build cheap, large storage plants, right? Or not just storage, just talk about the whole thing, right? They build all this stuff on the cheap. So to get back to your question earlier, you know, are people going to take, you know, are people going to start taking, you know, the big box companies to task for all the margin they have in their products? What we were just saying is that, you know, people need tested products so they can know that they're going to work, that they're not going to lose their jobs, that they're not going to lose their company's data assets, all of this stuff. Yet at the same time, there's this whole cloud world out there that just continues to hang out saying, we run it all on cheap stuff. How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, but that's apples and oranges, Mark, because they have the size, they have the architectural sizing where they can afford to design for failure. And designing for failure means lots of copies, different places, and they even make sure that disks do fail and have no issues. They can lose entire racks at the same time. That is, you can design architecture completely differently at that size.
4,000 nodes is very different to 4 nodes, right? You take a failure, or you take 20 failures in 4,000 nodes versus one failure in 4 nodes. That's the way I see what you're getting at there, Hans. And I get that in size and scale. But I think there's another thing to it as well, is that these companies, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Amazons and people, they have armies of super smart developers and architects and people that put all of these solutions together. Now, in the more enterprise space, we're wanting to buy into this OpenStack goodness, this software-defined goodness, but don't have that level of expertise there and don't necessarily have the testing resources, the labs and things to test and to put things through their paces and also to design things properly. That's another major difference. Now, we want all of this goodness, but in order to do that, are we going to need to upskill or increase the number of people we have on the floor in IT? Because that's not really going to happen, I don't think, in the enterprise.
And it may mean that private cloud isn't as interesting as public cloud because of the resources available to public cloud vendors.
Well, here's another really good question, Mark. I think that's a really good point. I'm wondering, right, now, I love the idea of OpenStack, and I am genuinely excited about it. But has the market interest in private cloud peaked? I mean, the public cloud stuff, these guys are innovating and bringing new ideas and products and services to market all the time. And people are moving to the public cloud, yet OpenStack production deployments, still only a, you know, very small number out there. And we had all this hype around private cloud. Are we losing interest in, and is there less value in the idea of private cloud as the public cloud matures?
I think OpenStack might be an enabler for hybrid.
I think that's also why you see EMC's primary chief strategy being hybrid cloud with the federation companies.
Hybrid cloud makes a lot more sense.
It's their entire focus is hybrid cloud. Private cloud hard, public cloud risky, hybrid cloud good.
So, but as the risk comes out of public cloud, what's the value and what's the proposition behind a private cloud?
Data control, regulation.
Data control and data localization. Yeah. There's still a lot of value. There's still a lot of value in being able to keep your company running when the internet's broken.
Okay.
Here, I like that.
I mean, I talked to, so I was at the VMUG in Birmingham yesterday, now at the VMUG in Denmark today, but, and I talked to someone and he said, we're producing millions of curries a week. And
nice.
Yeah, we have a production environment and these machines cannot even touch the internet, but I need a data center. And he even has two data centers in the same building and they only house like two or three hosts, but it has to be on site just for that one or two applications that run the entire production. So I'm okay that he, and he said, I may be able to move 80% of my software, everything that is back office software. Maybe I could even use Salesforce, but I cannot put all the whole production down because the internet is broke or because someone at Microsoft forgot to re-enable the certificate and all Azure is down. There are certain things you will never be able to afford to give to the cloud in entirely. And that's why, but there's a lot of value in putting everything that is not your business. Everything that is not your business should not be run in your own data center. I'm totally okay with that. That should be run in the cloud. So there's a lot of value in hybrid today to that, to solve that. Only run what is your business in your buildings.
So I totally get that today and probably for the next bunch of years, right? But I do wonder going forward beyond that, whether that will still be viable. I mean, the internet and connectivity and cloud-based services and stuff will be so fundamental to everything that the idea or the notion of them going down, I mean, surely you'll be able to HA across, what did you call it, Mark? Azure and AWS and, you know, to be able to make sure you're not just relying on one of those services, to have multiple internet connections out of your facilities, have multiple facilities of your own. I don't know.
Allow me to make the best analogy here when it comes to commoditization, and it's electricity. We do not produce our own electricity. We get it all from within the wire, from within the street. But when that wire goes down, we do have engines on fuel that run our own electricity to make our company running. That's the exact same analogy you use here.
So is that what EMC are building now, what Robin Harris was talking about? Having, I'm sure some of their products are having like kind of locally cached public cloud data on site. Or did I just make that up? I'm sure that...
I think you made it up, and it may be time to close this show with that.
I'm pretty sure I didn't make that up, but we'll see.
You better trademark that real quick before somebody else does.
Hello, this is Mark Farley, and you're listening to Secret Windows Phone Apps. And today, we're going to be talking about something that's very, very secret. The personal odor reduction app. Maybe you're hanging out in an elevator and someone gets on and, you know, passes a little gas. Or maybe, you know, you're in a meeting and it's a little stuffy in there and you notice that somebody has BO. Or maybe you're talking to your mom or your aunt or someone and they're kind of like smiling and you notice they have dog breath. And the next thing you know, the only thing you can think about is getting some relief as fast as possible. You may not have thought about it, but your Windows phone can really bail you out at times like these. The Personal Odor Reduction app gives you instant relief for foul smells coming from another human. And here's how it works. You go to a special website called EverythingSmells.com, and you'll see a fantastic array of scratch-and-sniff stickers sold there, from bubblegum to blueberry to caramel to daisy, fish, and you put the sticker on the front of your phone, right where you would normally dial the phone. And then, when somebody comes up to you and blows you away with their personal odor, you can just, like, say, "Excuse me for a minute, do you mind?" And you pull your phone out of your pocket, and you're kind of sneaky about it because you don't want them to see that you actually have a scratch and sniff sticker on the front of your phone. But they'll probably be wondering, is that a Windows phone? And while they're wondering that and thinking about it, you just keep scratching away until the smell starts coming from the sticker on your phone. And then you hold it up to your face like you're waiting for the person on the other end to pick up the phone, except you didn't actually dial anything. You're just smelling your phone, and you're just closing your eyes and waiting for their personal odor to go away while the odor of the grape or the fish or the tutti frutti from the sticker comes into your nose and takes away the awful smell. Tune in again to hear another episode of Secret Windows Phone Apps.